We are 200 episodes old. Join us for the 200th episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where we will talk about how the podcast came to be, the very first episode, all those episodes ago, how the podcast has evolved over the 200 episodes, the learnings from the top three most viewed episodes, and the two episodes that have had the biggest impact for your hosts, Colin Stewart and Sarah Hicks. Please join us for We Are 200 Episodes Old.
Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast.
Welcome, guys.
For the second time that you've probably heard that. Sarah, I'm excited to be back on the show with you. This is this is going to be fun.
It is going to be fun. It has been quite a long time since we have been on this together.
Yeah. Well, I think we were talking about it the other day, and it was the last time we recorded it in the office, didn't we?
Yeah. Yeah. So well over a year ago. Interesting.
Yeah. For those of you who are, I guess, haven't seen the script that we're, or the outline, basically this is our 200th episode. So this is going to be one of those like throwback episodes. We're going to talk about some of our favorite episodes over the last 200. We're going to talk about some highlights. We're going to talk a little bit about maybe some insider info on the podcast if you're curious. So if you're looking for something new, if you're not looking for one of those recap episodes from your favorite TV shows that you hate, feel free to skip this one. But if you want a little bit more about Sarah and I, then hang out.
Yeah. Well, for those of you who are brand spanking new, or for those of you who just want a little refresher on who we are, my name is Sarah Hicks. I am an SDR manager at Predictable Revenue. I started off as an outbound SDR and was in that role still when I started on the podcast here with Colin. And so excited to be here on the 200th episode. I remember one of my very first tasks as a prospector at Predictable Revenue was to reach out to some people who had listened to our 100th episode. So pretty amazing to think back on how different things were back then. We were in the office. I was brand new. I didn't know a thing about outbound or sales. And now I've learned so much. And so much of that is attributed to this podcast, being able to speak to all those incredibly talented and skilled guests that I've had the great fortune of meeting and interviewing. So I'm eternally grateful for the opportunity to have taken over the podcast.
You're welcome. Life debt, basically. So if you're a newbie and you only listen to the good ones with Sarah in them, then you may not recognize my voice, but I was my name's Colin. I'm the co-founder, co-CEO here at Predictable Revenue. And it was actually supposed to be Aaron and myself on the podcast. And then he kind of no-showed on the first couple of recordings. And so I was like, okay, I guess I'll do it solo. He did. I mean, his schedule's crazy. He's got like 1,000 kids. I mean, 9 actually. So I think we'd initially planned to do the first one, and I ended up, what happened? I think I ended up getting a last minute speaking request. And so I had to fly to this conference in Ottawa, and I ended up taking the first, recording the first episode with Zach Barney from the, I can't remember the name of the hotel, but it was in the front lobby of this huge hotel. So the sound wasn't great. I was on my MacBook Air. It wasn't even plugged in. I had just a headset. We've come a long way. Let's put it that way. Because the first one, if you listen to that, like the episode, the quality of the guest was incredible. Zach was almost intimidating to start off the podcast with because I had no idea what I was doing. But he gave me tons of feedback at the end. And, those first couple of guests really ended up shaping how, this podcast evolved, and it really kind of set the tone. So it was really, really interesting.
Yeah. What was that episode about? Do you remember?
We were doing, we were talking about spiffs. So basically outside of, and not just monetary spiffs, specifically we were talking about non-monetary spiffs. And so the one example I remember, I think he said for every meeting his team, I think he had a fairly sizable team, for every meeting they set in the month, he would do a push-up. And I want to say he ended up doing something like 1,000 push-ups.
Oh, man.
And then there was another one he did where for every something, I want to say maybe deal that turned into a meeting that an SDR passed and turned in and got converted, the SDR got to pie Zach. And he sat there and and there was these, he had great videos of him actually doing not all 1,000 push-ups, but he had videos of him doing push-ups, and I think he had a vine of him getting pied in the face. And the one guy just so slowly started at the very top, just very, very gently, and slowly worked it down. It was, yeah, it was awesome.
Nice.
Yeah. And then after the recording, we just sat there and talked sales for, I don't know, an hour. Got a ton of feedback from Zach. The next episode I did was with Matt Amundsen, just another guy who turned out to be just such a legend. Gave us great feedback in terms of, you know, here's what you're doing, and here's what's interesting. Here's the type of podcast that I would listen to. So I'd say, I know there was a number of influential people we had on, but I think those were the first two or in the first three episodes. And they, Zach and Matt, were highly influential, had a huge stamp on the podcast.
So cool. So interesting looking back this far on, and yeah, seeing the journey that it's taken, and 200 episodes means 200 guests. I think there's maybe a couple of people who've been on more than once, and mm-hmm. but that's only a couple of cases. I think there's Kim Brown, who I interviewed in the past few months, who had been on with you a couple of years ago, and so good. And I'm sure that there's been a couple more as well. But for the most part, that's like 200 individual guests who have graced the Predictable Revenue airwaves with their talent and their time and their expertise. And that's pretty incredible, just that in itself.
Yeah. I never thought about like, oh, is it going to get to 200 episodes? Like that thought never occurred to me. It was just a great thing to do. And eventually I just ran out of time to do it. And, you know, That's how we got Sarah here. Yeah, I mean, the learning, like you mentioned it earlier, the amount that you've learned. If you're mm-hmm. listening to this and you're either in the sales, if you're in any sort of sales or marketing or revenue role, the absolute best way to learn a market is to start a podcast, right? Like you can do customer development interviews, and those are really great as well. But I can say that the connections that I've built, the people I've met, the things that I've learned, the conversations I've had, just loaded my brain with a ton of really useful training data. On everything from how to pick out a great SDR, how to pick out a great SDR manager, what a good sales development program looks like. And to me, that's invaluable. And I think I was in 163 episodes, give or take, which that's a lot thinking back.
That's a lot.
And then you graciously, I don't know if you graciously accepted or if I was just like, hey, Sarah's doing it.
I think it might have been that. I think I remember Julia and Vero, who are our two members of our amazing marketing team. They said to me like, hey, Colin doesn't have time in his calendar for like this week, so can you please take over the podcast? And I was like, absolutely. Because one time before, you had been really, really sick and had actually sat with me in Zoom with the guest, kind of like prompting me on how to do it. Because it was a total last minute thing where the night before you're like, Sarah, I can't speak. And honestly, I feel like you had COVID back then, because that was like December. I think you were patient zero COVID in Canada. But you're like, I'm so sick, I can't do it. And it was with Bilal Batraoui. And so he was the very, very first person that I ever spoke to on the PR podcast. But I remember you like, yes, literally sitting in the background being like, here's what you're going to do. I like had your outline and was like trying to skim through it and everything. And it was great. He was like a wonderful guest, very easy to speak to and everything. And so I had like that little bit of practice. And then you were, you know, you couldn't do it that week or whatever. And so they put me in. And then like all of a sudden there were 6 podcasts a week in my calendar. And I was like, are these mine or is Colin? And they're like, no, you're going to do them. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. I'm in there. I'm doing it.
Yep. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, maybe we got a bit ambitious booking. I do remember in the early days we booked so many. I just don't think we were paying attention to our podcast inventory, because I would try and stick to one a week. And before we started, I tried to build up having 8 episodes in there. So we had a bit of a buffer. So if I got sick, we could push things out, or if a guest no showed, you know, which didn't happen too often. But when you're dealing with VPs of sales and sales leaders, like, and you're booking a meeting for the end of the quarter, like, you know, that's going to get pushed. So It happens. But we definitely overloaded Sarah in the early days. And I remember the conversation.
It was great.
I remember the conversation with Julian. It was good. I'm like, hey, I'm getting a bit tired. I don't have time in my calendar. I'm so maxed out. And we both kind of like looked at each other and we're like, yeah, she should do it. I think, yeah, maybe we should, we could have shopped it around a bit, but I think it was just such an obvious choice. I mean, yeah, you won us over with your interview, with your initial job interview. Right. I'm pretty sure we've told that story already, so we don't have to go back into it.
Yeah.
If you want to hear the story, go find the episode that Sarah and I did together.
Well, we're actually going to talk about that in a little bit. So we won't tell you the story again, but you'll know where to find that episode and which episode that it, the wonderful details are shared in.
That's right. This is going to be an interesting one because we're going through some of our, like some of the highest, the most viewed episodes. And then Sarah and I cherry picked a couple favorites. Some that I think the most, I picked the one that was most impactful on me and predictable revenue.
Yeah. And the one that I chose was most impactful on me as an SDR manager, which is a position that I've taken just at the beginning of this year. So honestly, if I had to pick one that was most influential on me as an SDR, I could not have, because honestly, it was every single one. It was like, I learned so much every single time I spoke to somebody. So I've had to narrow it down to just the one that I feel has had the greatest impact on my team and kind of their success. I'm excited to dive into it. But so we're going to talk about some of our top viewed. So there's three that are the three top viewed from the whole 200. And we're going to dive in a little bit. We'll share some snippets with you guys of kind of, yeah, highlights from that episode. And we'll chat a little bit about them. Colin, what's the first one that we're talking about here?
So this was episode 11. So they've had a bit of an advantage. We shared this pretty heavily. And a lot of people would ask me about how do I personalize my outreach and messaging sequence, outreach, whatever you want to call it. If we think back, I want to say this is 2017, give or take. So episode 11, yeah, I think it was like May, June, 2017. Personalization was still a relatively new thing. I mean, SalesLoft have been talking about it for a long time. But if I think back to response rates in 2017, they were for pure non-personalized email, they were still actually pretty decent. And so it wasn't the everything has to be personalized camp that I think is maybe a little bit more common right now. John Miller was just starting to talk about Engageo. So the ABM or account-based sales development was still fairly new. But talking with David Mordzinski, who is, I think at the time he was a SDR at Demandbase. And I want to say between recording and publishing, he might've got a bit of a title bump. So there might be something different. We talked about basically like how he in 2 minutes, how he goes from, I can't believe I'm remembering all this. Like I'm not looking down at the script. Basically it was his algorithm for looking at somebody's LinkedIn and in 2 minutes pulling out how he's going to personalize his first touch, his second touch, his follow-up. And he basically outlined his algorithm in terms of like, here's how I think about it. This is what I look at first. Here's the most powerful things. If they're not there, do this. If they're not there, do this. So why don't we have a listen to that? And you and I are actually going to listen to this. We'll pause and somebody on our marketing team is going to edit it in. But why don't we have a listen right now? And then I think it's a minute clip and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the next one. Or maybe we'll do a little recap on this, some interesting things, and then we can move on to the next one.
Sounds good.
Personalized, right? Like what's in it for me? There's going to be a ton of extra effort, extra work. Talk to me about like the difference between just that sort of blanket mass template approach versus what you're doing.
Well, I would disagree if people say it's more work to personalize an email. Would you rather send out 100 generic emails or 10 personalized ones? What's more work?
Oh, you just queue them up into a big system and it's off. It's brainless.
Right, but at the end of the day, reply rates matter. Right?
Totally.
You send out 100 emails and nothing comes out of it. You ask the question, what's in it for me? Well, if you do that, you don't get anything, right? Mm-hmm. If you end up personalizing 10 emails and you get 3 responses back, that's what's in it for you.
Cool. Is that generally the sort of response rates you're expecting with these emails?
He's like, let's get to the funnel metric.
Well, that's a great question.
How many? Yeah, what'd you get?
It really always depends. And I think there's two common factors. It's really A, the title / responsibility that your prospect has, and then B, an action that they took, right? If you can see that a prospect's been on your site, chances, the reply rate's up to 50%. If it's a completely cold email, it might be closer to 25%.
So That was an interesting one. I had to avoid, I was cringing pretty hard looking at, like, listening to the audio, me on my, like, my Plantronics boom mic, and looking at the, not even paying attention to the lighting. So all of those, like, little things that we've learned along the way, the production quality has certainly got a whole lot better from what it was. I remember I never, for the early podcasts, I'd just be sitting there in, like, a green shirt. You're like, did I shower today? Did I not shower today? I eventually got into a lot more, like, paying attention to things, but I don't think I took it very seriously in the early days. So anyway, that's what I see when I look at this. But what I remember was that basically the conversation around, should I personalize it? Should I not? And I love David's comment. He's like, it's basically the same amount of work to send, you know, 200 emails as it is to send 10 really good ones. And you're going to get a whole lot better of a response rate from 10 really good ones. So why would you bother messing around with, you know, the mass send? It was really interesting to see how everybody was thinking about that, like, so far back. And I think Demandbase, they were, as a company, I want to say they are sort of like, they were one of the leaders in the account-based marketing space. So maybe he had a bit of an inside edge in working for that company, but I could be misremembering Demandbase. And so if Demandbase, if you're listening, I apologize. Send me an email and we'll get it corrected.
Yeah. So interesting. It's interesting because that was many years ago now. That was, like, we're saying 2017. So that's four years ago, almost 4 years ago now. And we're talking about, starting to personalize these emails, because the sort of mass, the spray and pray approach where you're personalizing the one custom variable of, like, hey, Colin, and you're like, whoa, me, was no longer working at that point. And it's so interesting because with a lot of things, there seems to be, like, a pendulum swing, and it is not the case with this. The pendulum has not swung back towards being able to do, like, a spray and pray approach. We have absolutely left that in the dust. And while going, like, full only personalization has never actually picked up traction in the way that maybe somebody like David thought it might, because there's still that time element to it where you're like, automation versus personalization. I'm still only one person, and it's a numbers game at the end of the day. But it's interesting because we do still talk about this, and it's also still contentious. Like, people still disagree about whether or not you should personalize everything, or you should personalize some things, or whether relevance is just good enough. So it's interesting to, because you even sort of threw him, like, a devil's advocate type question in that clip that we watched, where you're like, why would I bother? Like, it's mindless if I just pop everybody into my, you know, automation tool, my enablement tool, and just send off 100 emails. Why would I bother? And he's saying, like you said, Colin, well, if you send 10 good things and get 3 out of it at a 30% response rate, but you send 100 and you get nothing, well, that tells you the answer to your question. So, and honestly, it is still something we're talking about today. So it's interesting.
Yeah. I think the thing that I hadn't quite fully formed in my head yet was the idea of, like, sales development strategy, right? And looking at not what's better, because there are no silver bullets. If I had silver bullets, if there was one, I would have found it by now, and I'd have been selling it for $1,000 a shot. And guaranteed, there are no silver bullets. Unfortunately, everything is going to be dependent on so many different variables, and it starts with your funnel math. What can you afford to invest in order to convert a customer? That's going to be different for every single company. If you take it down to the penny or whatever it is, like, nobody's going to have the exact same amount. And so, the size of your market, how much your customers are worth. There's a mathematical formula that you can get to if you make some, you know, if you say, okay, well, I think I'm going to get this sort of response rate, and off of these responses, I think I'm going to book this many meetings. You can figure out, oh, and I need to, you know, wait this long in between sequences. You can sort of figure out and optimize for, well, what is the right number of times, or how many times can I reach out to this individual? And you can start to get a feel for what is the right size of sales development team for this market. And if you only have 100 customers, like, David was working in an organization where I think he was a named account rep. Like, he was an SDR, but he only had 200 accounts he could work. So if you only have 200 accounts, and maybe there's, you know, 5 to 10 people, okay, that's a fairly large one. Maybe he had even less. Anyway, I remember the math, like doing the math with him. And I think this is the, this is one of the key points, is that there's, it just, it really depends on the size of the market that you're going after and how much each of those deals is worth.
Yeah, absolutely. If you've only got 200 accounts, you better make it, you better make it count. Your outreach better count, because you can't just burn through 200 sends in one day. And then you're like, guess I'm waiting 90 days to recycle these guys.
Right.
And but that's that.
But if you're an SDR and you have 20,000 accounts and they're all worth a $10,000 instead of $100,000, then spray and pray probably would work for one SDR. Not saying for all.
Yeah, but you're still going to burn through contact, but yeah, you might get enough out of it at a, you know, point whatever, 0.05 response rate. It's enough to sustain one person, but well, no, 0.05 is high. I meant 0.05 open rate.
There you go.
Yeah.
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 If you're only, like, if you're doing that spray and pray, but you're only hitting them once a year, you know, it's it's impossible to say, because somebody on the other end is going to be like, they said we could spray and pray. And that's totally not the moral of the story.
You can spray and pray if you have the like relevance down as well. You can't just like spray and pray a terrible message. You've got to go, you know, like persona, industry, super hyper relevant. Mm-hmm. You maybe don't have to go personalize off their LinkedIn. It's still got to be hyper relevant. And then maybe you can do the mass automated outreach.
So interesting to connect the dots here, because one of the things that I think drove our account strategy team, and if you're not familiar with predictable revenue, part of our part of what we do is book meetings for people, build SDR teams, et cetera, et cetera. What drove people insane on our account strategy team, the account managers that also do like sequence design and messaging workshops, et cetera, was I would do one of these podcasts and I'd come back and be like, oh, I just talked to David and he says this. And then I'd go and we'd try and replicate it internally, and the results would flop. Yeah. And I'm like, I know we don't have dumb people, right? So like, that's out of the equation. So like, what's not, well, like, why aren't we connecting the dots here? What's missing? And it was this sort of, it wasn't specifically this episode. I can't say which episode it was. It was probably a culmination of a number of episodes, but me doing these episodes and then going to the strategy team, be like, hey, why don't we try this? It was sort of the genesis of Outbound Labs, because everybody was sick and tired of me coming to them, be like, hey, why don't we test this? Hey, why don't we test that? And finally, I want to say it was Kenny, was like, listen, we're not actually testing anything. We need all this to be statistically significant. We need to run these in batches. There needs to be parameters. We can't just cowboy this like you've been doing. And so it was me being annoying and Kenny being intelligent. And that's where Outbound Labs came from. So if you've seen any of that Outbound Labs content on YouTube, you can thank Kenny and maybe me like 1% for being super annoying. And if you did like that content, that's coming back in a big way later this year, which I'm pretty excited about. We haven't quite figured out how we're going to produce all of that and how we're going to wrap that into whether it's podcasts or YouTube or whatever, but we've basically have all of our, I think all of our clients, our team is running an experiment for at least one of our clients, for every single one of our clients. So we've got quite a bit more data than we did before. So I'm really excited about that. But anyway, I just thought I'd sort of connect those dots between learning things on the podcast and then finding a way to test them. Because like you said, there is no right or wrong answer. The best thing that you can do is try and pull out, okay, here's something that's interesting. Let's find a meaningful way to test this out and see if it works for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is kind of a good segue into our next top watched or listened to episode, because it's a similar idea. It is a personalization strategy that, according to, or kind of in keeping with what David said, got me as a sales rep 130% of my quota every time I used this strategy. And so it was a LinkedIn focused personalization strategy that I absolutely stole from Beck Holland, and it worked incredibly well. And like you're saying, it works only for, well, there are a lot of parameters, let's say. We'll watch the clip and get a little taste of it, but there are a lot of things that have to kind of fall into place for this strategy to work. So it's not the kind of one that we could say like, hey, all of our clients are now going to use this and everyone's going to get a hit 130% quota. There are, yeah, it's persona specific. It's people being active on LinkedIn specific, but yeah, let's watch the clip and then we'll chat a little bit more about it.
So talk to me about what this looks like in the eyes of the prospect.
For sure. So in this email that they're receiving, basically it's speaking either to the the post that they liked or reacted to or commented on as a whole, or if they commented something specific, then it's speaking to their comment itself. Obviously, if that's something that's relevant and that we can tie into our own value prop for predictable revenue. So it's kind of a short and to the point email that shows not only that I've done research on them and I can show you exactly what that research is and I've pulled something kind of meaningful from that research, but it also allows me to basically offer up predictable revenue as a solution, a potential solution to whatever pain was mentioned in that initial post that they interacted with or commented on. And if they mentioned something valuable in that comment, I can even tie it back to that comment itself.
Cool. And I love how you're using sort of the something that they're commenting on to sort of, you know, one is sort of it's a trigger, and then using that to sort of tie into the value prop that you in the conversation that you want to have.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, you're already thinking about this. Why don't we continue the conversation this
exactly,
way?
Exactly. Yeah.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. And so I know we were going to get into how does it work first, but I want to front load this piece. I mentioned earlier that you were 130% quota, you know, the first time that you tried this, like right out of the gate. Can you talk to me just a little bit about some of the results? And we don't have to go super deep because I know we've got some time for that a little bit later, but Sure. Can you give a high level if there's a sales manager or an SDR that's listening is like, hey, why should I try this process?
For sure. So the first time I ever tried this campaign, I think it was like a 96% open rate and a 36% response rate. And even though not all of the responses were positive, I was getting what I call positive negative responses. So as an SDR, you know that so many of your emails just go completely ignored. People are probably clicking you into spam or people are saying, no, thank you, unsubscribe or whatever. And that's kind of the extent of the negative responses that you'll get to see. But I was getting people respond back saying, hey, this is like a really great first prospecting email. I've never seen one as good as this. So even though we can't do this for X, Y, Z reasons, this is really fantastic. So, and yeah, as Colin mentioned, in the first month that I was doing this, hit 130% of the quota. So way more meetings coming from one specific type of campaign than I would normally have. I'd obviously normally be pulling in meetings from a bunch of different campaigns, but
Cool. So yeah, that strategy is one that does tie in pretty well with David's episode that we were talking about first. It's personalizing using stuff on LinkedIn. And it was a bit of a different approach. I mentioned that I absolutely stole it from Beck Holland, and that's because this is her approach for when you have an account-based list, again, similar to David. It's how to take that prospect that you have, go look on their LinkedIn and find the best possible stuff to use for personalization. And then she had a great template for how to create a really short, sweet email that would refer to that personalization content and grab their attention. The issue, of course, being that when I had my list of people that I was reaching out to, they didn't always have a lot of activity on LinkedIn. And so I wasn't able to use this strategy, but I knew it was really good. And so I went the opposite way and I found a post that was already relevant to PR, or the content was already relevant to the type of stuff that we could help. And I pulled the people commenting or liking those posts and reached out to them using the same Beck Holland personalization technique. And yeah, it was great. It was the same type of results that David was talking about in his episode, where my quota, I hit like 130% of quota that month. The open rates on one of them was ridiculous. It was like 96% open rate on one of these campaigns. And the reply rates were all in the like 30s, 40s. And the interesting thing was, of course, open rates and reply rates are one thing, but what you really care about is the positive reply rates. Like you could have 100 negatives and say it was a high response rate, and that would not be good. But with these people, even when they were giving me a negative, it wasn't like, no, thank you, unsubscribe. It was like, this was the best cold outbound email I've ever gotten. I don't want to work with you, but I needed to tell you that I really liked this. Like, this is different from anything I've ever gotten. I loved it. And other people like jokingly being like, I have an opening for an outbound SDR if you want to switch jobs over here.
I was just going to say, it's not a great sales development email unless you get at least one job offer.
Yeah, exactly. exactly. And I'd see people like share it around their whole companies. And then like somebody would reply accidentally including me on the reply. And I'd see the people that it had been bounced around to and stuff. So people loved it. And even with those negative replies that were these, what I would call positive negatives, there were a lot of positive positives because I did hit 130% quota. So that was a prime example of when personalization was very effective. Now, of course, it doesn't work for everybody because not everybody's ICP is going to be very active on LinkedIn. You can substitute LinkedIn for Twitter or forums or somewhere else that you might be able to find your prospects sharing stuff or being active. But it's not a silver bullet. There is no such thing as a silver bullet. But that being said, it was still a great strategy and one that does hold up. In the case where personalization, when you've got great content to use, good, strong personalization still does generate a higher positive response rate, but it really has to be the right stuff. It can't just be any old piece of personalization junk. So, yeah.
Yeah. Did you do any cold calls that month?
No. I think I maybe did a couple of like engagement calls where if somebody had opened this one more than once or like shared it with five people at their company, I would give them a ring. But honestly, once I started getting the traction, I was like, nice, I could just do a bunch of these. And I just kept going and building, compiling lists of these posts that would be good fodder for this type of campaign. And honestly, my volume was low. It would be like, because there'd only be, say, maybe like 25 people of 100 who were in ICP that had commented and that had commented something actually useful, not just like tagging their friend and being like, this is dope. and so it was really high conversion. Like I wasn't blasting through a high volume. Like David was saying, I was able to do like maybe five of these campaigns at once that only had 20 people active in them, but were getting me, my quota at that point was 10 meetings per month. And so this was 13 meetings, like, you know, qualified and accepted on the AE side that were generated just from this. And yeah, like you said, no calls.
Yeah. And that, like, for context there, those 13 meetings, those aren't like, it's not like those are low bar, right? Mm-hmm. They need to be within ICP. They need to be accepted and moving forward.
Yeah. And we do our part of our sales methodology is the SDR doing the qualification call, or as we call it, the Are We a Fit call. In a lot of cases, the SDR is simply booking that first meeting for the account executive. That's not how we do it. I would have a whole Are We a Fit call where I'd run through a laundry list of qualification criteria that these people need to meet and then convince them to get on that on the line. So there's always a bit of a drop off there. So 13 meetings attended on the AE side means maybe, you know, 14, 15 could have been booked. You know, right off the bat.
Totally. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't have much to add. This was a great example of figuring out, of like finding something on LinkedIn and like trying it. Okay, that doesn't work because, and then finding a different sort of way to reframe it and pull it in. And I think that's the sort of, I don't know, that's the best part about this podcast, is that's my hope for what the listeners are doing. And I've had the pleasure of connecting with a number of them. I was in IKEA in Richmond a couple of years ago. Like, I think we were maybe 50, 60 episodes in. And someone's like, oh, hey, Colin, and recognize me. And I'm trying to like, I don't recognize this person at all. And then he's like, oh, I listened to your podcast. Like, oh, once.
Wow.
It happened once. It's like, I'm a celebrity. Not really.
But that's awesome.
The best part is that other people are learning from the podcast and they're taking what they're finding here and hopefully copying you and maybe trying to reframe it and make it work for them. Because this is the hardest job in sales, and anything we can do to make this just a little bit easier to hit that quota, I think means more people that not only are hitting their quota, are making that commission, are staying in the sales profession, which is an amazing place to be.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. That is the only... the only universal truth, or the only standard in outbound sales, is experimentation and the need to experiment. And so, yeah, doing stuff like this and listening to these strategies and then making them your own is what outbound is all about.
Great. So it's been interesting. We've been LinkedIn for the first three. There seems to be a common theme among the most popular episodes, because the next one we're going to talk about is also looking at LinkedIn. And we were talking with Tom at SoCo Selling, or SoCo Sales Training, sorry, about how he uses LinkedIn to go from, you know, 100 profiles and turn that into 10 meetings.
But what you want to be doing first, and this is something that that organizations can do, but equally, you know, SDRs can do, right? And I think that's what's really important. Individual SDRs can do this, is they need to start building their own profile on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. All right. So they need to build their own profile on LinkedIn and, you know, start creating some content. So they can either create content on their own, or they can simply recycle or repurpose content from the, from their company. But what they need to do is to start positioning themselves on LinkedIn as, you know, an authority in their space. That's super critical, right? So they need to be positioned as someone who is a problem solver for a specific type of person or an industry. Mm-hmm. So you want to start building that following. So something that we did, you know, over the course of the last few months is we built my LinkedIn following from about maybe 5,000 or 7,000 people to now we've got over 20,000, I think maybe 22 or maybe even 24,000 connect, but you know, north of 20,000 connections. So, you know, that's a very deliberate strategy, right? You want to have a big profile, a big reach, a big following, right? And some people might go, well, you know, why does it matter? Well, because it, you know, that expression, it's not who you know, but it's who knows you, right? How many people know you? So mm-hmm. when you've got those people that know you and they start to see your stuff and they see your content and you're just giving and giving and giving and giving, and I'll share more about that later, when you're just giving some great content, that kind of sets them up for when you now go out and start to approach people. Because I'm a big believer, Colin, you know, when people talk about, you know, cold calls or cold emails or cold outreach, screw cold. You know, it's cold for a reason. I'm not a big fan of that. You know, for me, that's dark ages stuff. To me, that's like, you know, machine gun, kind of that, you know, spray and pray approach. But we're more into like kind of this sniper approach and going after people that we feel like are the right people, but they also might have a genuine interest and at least will be receptive to hearing from us because they may have seen my stuff on LinkedIn before and they're like, okay, let me give this guy a few minutes.
So this would be an interesting one to talk about because I recorded the episode. And I mean, episode 44. So this is 144. This was recent-ish, but it was still a while ago. And I think the most interesting piece here is even though I recorded this, Sarah actually knows this better. This was right around when you started, you were ghostwriting for us and still are writing for us and for the blog. And so anything that you, yeah, there's quite a bit of good, great content that's coming out. And Sarah is the person behind a good deal of it. Both on the writing side and on the audio side. So you've actually, not only have you written an article about this, but you've also put this into practice. So why don't I hand it to you? Why don't you walk us through Tom's method, and then I can maybe add some color commentary from what I remember.
Yeah, absolutely. So this one stood out to me because it was around maybe the first time that I heard somebody speaking about social selling as a long game. So for a long time, LinkedIn was the emerging channel where tons of meetings were being booked. You were able to reach out to somebody, like connect with them, send them a message and book a meeting within, you know, two backs and forth. And it was quick. It was quick conversion. And then it started to lose its steam, as any good channel does. And this was the first time that I had seen somebody share a really great strategy for not doing it like that. So that was why it really stood out to me right away. And his strategy was really great because he had the actual method or strategy, including messaging, on how you actually speak to somebody if you're not going to pitch to them, because that's what's difficult. Like, you connect with somebody and then what are you supposed to do after they've accepted your connection request? You're like, hey, how's it going? And they're like, well, I don't know you. And you're like, yeah, I know. So this was really interesting for me. So he has his connection request, and he talks about expanding his network in his connection request. So he's not going to come in and sell you. You can tell that from that connection request, and that's great. And he doesn't bait and switch. He doesn't come in and sell you anyway, which is definitely a tactic that I've been victim to. There's been people that have sent me those messages, and then it's always like really upsetting when you get sold something. You're like, oh man, I thought we were going to connect about something cool. And then he's just trying to get me to buy something. So, so he doesn't, he talks about making an effort to expand his network,
Are you open to connecting? You connect. Then his follow-ups are non-threatening, non-salesy. They make it easy for the prospect to say yes, but not tricking them into saying yes about, you know, a meeting or sales or anything. So he says, you know, hey, Colin, thank you for connecting. If there's anything I can do to help you, feel free to reach out. Cheers. And then he leaves it at that. And then he starts to slowly build credibility and provide value over the next couple of steps. So he, for instance, if he's got, you know, a webinar that he thinks would be really useful for you, he'll drop that with a bit of context for you. He'll give you a few things that'll be really useful for you that are tailored to you. And so that you can tell that he's put some effort into figuring out what you might do, what issues you might be having, and then giving you this free content to help you solve it. And it's not until the kind of fourth step, fifth step that he starts to make some asks, and they're very soft and non-threatening. He has a 24% positive response rate by the first time he asks this, the CTA. And it's just a quick question, who would be the best person at Predictable Revenue to have the initial chat with about training for your sales team? Because of course, SoCo provides sales training. It's very gentle. It's not asking for time. And then step five, he goes for a little bit more of a slightly more aggressive ask. And then there's a big follow-up cadence that he gives you as well. That was a 9-step multi-channel, many day follow-up sequence. And you guys can go back and listen to the episode if you want to get the full rundown on that. But it was incredible because it's long. It is this long sequence where you're not getting the like instant gratification early on. And it was the first time that I had seen somebody teaching about a LinkedIn strategy like that. And absolutely, LinkedIn has 100% lost its steam as this like connect and pitch type platform. So it is something that I do continue to refer back to today.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple interesting things to point out. And I think I'll start with like talking about the channel and then maybe just a little bit of some context in terms of like, I think the journey of the podcast. And I think looking at Outbound Labs, which is something that I was running in parallel or around this time, one of the experiments we did was around relevance, right? And we did a lot around, you know, is this relevant to you? And so we ran a bunch of similar experiments. We actually had a Predictable Revenue last year. We had a service that was primarily based on LinkedIn. One thing I can say is that if your message is relevant and you're not super annoying about it, it's not copy paste, you know, it doesn't look like a marketing email shoehorned into LinkedIn, it's probably going to do okay if you're relevant. And if you really, not just if you're relevant, but if you actually understand that. I think tactics aside are probably more micro adjustments. The macro adjustments, the big movements that you can make are actually sending the right message to the right person. I think everything else is just like fine tuning to like a couple of percentage points max here and there. So I think that's this sort of my comment on the channel. I think in the last, I don't know, 12 months, 18 months, LinkedIn has become quite a bit more of a, there's quite a bit more automation that lives on LinkedIn. We were guilty of using it for a period of time. We don't anymore. So I don't want to be a hypocrite and say, oh, it's bad and you should never do that. I think there's a time and a place for most things in sales, and I'm always willing to try anything. Case in point, Pete tried that. What was it? Sending calendar invites like cold.
Yeah.
100% response rate. Everybody responded pretty negatively. Wasn't good. He tried it with warm people he'd already been trying to book a meeting with, had actually a pretty strong response rate. But anyway, so LinkedIn as a channel, I think if you are relevant with your people, just like with any channel, you're going to get a decent, as long as you're a human about it. I think how this relates to my journey on the podcast, this feels like, it's funny, I remember Tom, I remember recording the episode. I'm not remembering the content as much. And I think, I don't want to say I was checking out, but in terms of the evolution of Predictable Revenue, this is right around when I was taking a step back from pulling myself out of the details. And I think one thing I always tried to balance with this show was I never was had the role sales development rep. I prospected a whole ton. I was a full stack rep for 10 years, and a good chunk of that involved, or I think almost every job involved prospecting and cold calling or knocking on doors, but I never actually held the title sales development rep. And I think there was something, there was kind of a line to draw, you know, when I was involved, when I was more involved in the account strategy team and planning out things, I had a conduit to test some of this experience. And I started feeling around this time, I can't say it was this specific episode, but it was around this time where I'm like, I'm not sure I belong here. And not that I'm not enjoying the podcast, I've learned a ton and I really, really enjoy sales. But this is a podcast dedicated to sales development and booking meetings. And I just wasn't in it in the day to day anymore. And so I was, that this is right around when I started thinking, hey, we should bring somebody in who's actually doing this, who can speak from experience instead of me speaking from, oh, I've been a you know, salesperson back in the day, and back in my day we had fake machines and we knocked on doors, and you know, like, it just, I think I was, experience wise, it was becoming less and less relevant to what was happening, what was new, what was hip. So that's what brought you, Sarah. She's new and hip.
Just me. hip is what they call me.
As you look on our LinkedIn, that's what it says.
Yes.
I'll send you a LinkedIn recommendation.
Hip. Yeah. You should endorse me for being hip. Yeah.
There you go.
Oh, absolutely.
So it wasn't just sheer laziness in terms of why I gave up or handed off the podcast to you. And I still am recording a couple episodes here and there, but my experience is more focused on, I've been the CEO for 9 years. I haven't been, and I jump back into sales every now and then, but I haven't done that in a while. So I'm trying to focus on those higher level, like executive level episodes that are harder to track down sometimes. But lower volume, higher, hopefully slightly different conversations. But I am very grateful that you were able to take up the podcast and do such a great job.
Thank you. Yeah, honestly, it has been it has had such a huge impact on both my ability as an SDR and then now on my ability to manage people and be able to this kind of spirit of experimentation, which is something that we really hold dear at Predictable Revenue. It's something that I have been able to share with and impart on my team because it's something that I was able to do myself. Yeah, we talk about the need to experiment and stuff, but if you don't give your SDRs an environment where they feel safe to do so and supported to do so, and also have sort of like the base amount of meetings, I guess you have to have a validated strategy that you know you can fall back on before you can go experiment. Because if you're just blindly experimenting, you don't know where you're getting your meetings from, you're panicking, it's tough. So being able to work for a company like Predictable Revenue, who of course has that experience under its belt, gave me the platform and the environment to be able to go and experiment. And then that's huge because I feel that my learnings as an SDR accelerated far, far more quickly than I think a lot of more traditional companies with sales reps that just do the thing that they're told to do for, you know, 2 years and that's that. So yeah, and the podcast, of course, has had a huge part in that. And I think that's a good segue into the episodes that have had the biggest impact on Predictable Revenue as a company. There are so many. This is difficult. It's very difficult to narrow this down. I was saying to Colin earlier that if I had to narrow it down to the episode that had the biggest impact on me as an SDR, I absolutely could not do it because that was where the majority of those episodes sat because I only have just recently become a manager. But I was able to narrow it down to the most influential episode for me as a SDR manager. And that episode was with Chad Sanderson. It was episode 189, so quite recent, only 11 episodes ago. And it was how to keep your sales team from killing your brand and your bottom line. There is tons of stuff in that episode that's incredibly valuable. And we will listen to a clip on smoothing the SDR to AE handoff because it's something, again, we care about a lot of Predictable Revenue and is so valuable. But one other piece that isn't in that clip that I have told my reps time and time again, I've shared it a bunch of times, is Chad talks about the fact that in B2B sales, we haven't yet nailed this sort of like relevant personalized experience that B2C sales has been able to do. If you think about the fact that if you get like marketing, targeted ads and marketing from a company that you like targeting you as a consumer, you're totally okay with that. in fact, you're like, wow, yeah, I do like those shoes. I really appreciate that they know my style. But if you were, but you also know that they are sending that to like thousands of other people and it's got, they don't care about you at all, but it's okay. We don't mind that. Whereas B2B, it's completely different. They're two different beasts. You cannot treat B2B that way. And I didn't really know why. And Chad puts it in perspective where as a consumer, you willfully enter a consumer environment. So for instance, you walk into a store, you are agreeing, in fact, asking to be sold to. If you're on social media, somewhere that you know you get targeted ads, you again are agreeing to, if not asking to be targeted. You're willfully entering a consumer environment. Colin, who is doing his work as a CEO all day, is not in a consumer environment. And you coming in with an outbound email, entering his consumer environment and asking him to become a consumer will not work. You have to like, you have to get in there with something else and then coax that person into the consumer environment. You cannot just pull somebody in. They won't go unwillingly. So that was something that was so interesting for me because I could never quite put my finger on why you shouldn't send like a marketing style email to somebody as a sales email. Like I get it conceptually. It's because they know that it's going out to a bunch of people, but like, what's really the problem with that? Don't people know that they're going to get marketing style emails? Like why doesn't it work? And it's that, people are not sitting there doing their day-to-day job, sitting in a consumer environment, but as consumers in, you know, various marketplaces or out in public or whatever we are. So that was a really interesting piece that is not in this clip, but let's watch the clip.
Love it.
So imagine this is a kind of organization that has that SDR AE split. They've done a really great job, that SDR, bringing this prospect through the funnel. They've agreed to that that next meeting with the AE. What does a good AE handoff look like in a real buyer centric?
Yep. That is one of the friction points internally that we often see. So when we ideally, what you want is the prospect, you want your CSD to be able to say, hey, this prospect told me they have this problem. I haven't gotten a time-bound quantifiable element, but they told me they have this problem. They're trying to achieve this goal. I shared with them this story and I've asked them these couple of questions. Here's the information. Here's some other stories that I believe would resonate with them based on this prospecting prompter that we create. And now if the AE has been trained in the value selling framework, they convert that into a conversation with an individual. When we prospect, we're prospecting to a role in an industry. When that handoff happens, we have to provide enough information that now the AE can go to a level to continue the conversation without making them repeat themselves so that they can sell to the individual. So ideally, you should be able to do an SDR or BDR handoff to an AE in about 10, 15 minutes. And we see companies where they're spending 50 minutes, 60 minutes on these handoffs when it doesn't need to be that, because then all you're doing is confusing. Chances are AE is not going to remember half the information anyway. Then they're going to start asking questions that makes the prospect repeat themselves, and nobody likes that. So that concise, using a framework, prospecting prompter in our parlance, prospecting prompter to a value prompter, allows that conversation and that buying experience to be consistent and to grow organically so that it feels like a natural evolution of the relationship. And what we see is, as a result, we see significant increases in deal sizes, increases in sales velocity so that deals close faster. We see a huge increase in forecast accuracy because I know exactly what I have, what I don't, what I need to get, right? And as a result, those metrics that are put off allow the business to do what it needs to do without compromising that relationship of creating a frictionless buying experience all the way through.
Really interesting listen. That was... Yeah, it's interesting. Like, it's obviously the podcast, and I'm looking, I'm like, well, I'm not there. What's going on? just before we stepped out for a second there, you mentioned, you were talking about, you know, me, like if somebody was emailing me, I didn't walk into a store, so I'm not in a buying context. I love that mm-hmm. call out. I think one of the things that I thought as a rep that was early in my career, I remember reading like Robert Cialdini's Psychology of Persuasion and all these books, sort of similar, some neuro-linguistic programming, some things like that. They all basically were hacks because I thought I could, I mean, at the end of the day, manipulate somebody into, and I had no malice. I was just thinking, oh, I can do these little things that will make them this much more likely, but it's manipulation. And I think one thing over my sales career, sort of as you were sort of building on your idea, one thing that I've learned is you can't manipulate people. what you can do is understand that is identify that there's a need, right? You can only find the need. You can only find something that already exists. You cannot make something exist. And I know this mm-hmm. goes back to like the early Miller Hyman days where they talk about buying mode and this and that. And so if you're interested, you can check out the new Solution Sailing. I think that book was written in like maybe 1998 or something like that. So it's not super new anymore. Maybe they've updated it. But that was something that took me a long time to learn. And I really like, and I think I had to relearn that lesson when I learned how to write cold emails. Because as soon as I started writing cold emails, I was going in for the kill. Mm-hmm. I was making the assumption that because they're in my ICP, that they're ready to buy.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, hey, I know you're ready to buy. So why don't we hop on a call and talk about it? And that was my call to action on almost all of my emails was, you ready to buy? Okay, great. Why don't we book a meeting for this and this and that? Mm-hmm. And I remember, I don't know, I think it was some of our outbound lab stuff and probably on Relevance where we ran all these tests. And maybe it was a bit before then, but this was one event that I remember specifically where we went with more of a soft ask. We started with, hey, I'm working in this space, or I'm doing something in this space, or here's an article in this space. Is that relevant to you? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure how it was going to work. I remember like talking about the tests ahead of time and thinking like, oh, you know, we'll see. And it was, it massively blew out asking for the meeting right away. Mm-hmm. Massive, massive, massive difference. I know it's slightly different, but I think the relevant, like I'm not in a buying mode and you don't even know that I'm in a buying mode. You don't know that I'm in my desk and you're not, by sending me that email that's templated that says, hey, book a meeting, you're not respecting that I'm sitting at my desk and this is my email and you're infringing on my personal time or I don't know, on my personal email checking time where I'm getting those little dopamine hits from new emails and I click on yours. I'm like, ah, you're making all of these assumptions about that I'm the right person, that I have this pain and that I have enough pain to actually want to do something about it and book a meeting with you. And when I mm-hmm. see sales development emails that, or LinkedIn messages or whatever it is, and they make those assumptions, like I feel like we did have a couple of great years, or maybe it's just the people that were targeting me at the time. There was a couple of good years in 2019, pre-COVID, maybe beginning of 2020, where people were being really thoughtful with their messaging and I was getting really good sales development messages. It seems like that's all flipped and people have gone back to like just straight up trying to book the meeting. Mm-hmm. If somebody has put time and thought and research into cold emailing me, I absolutely will respond. Even if they're like, it's not super relevant, I always respond. I shouldn't say always, I always try to respond and sometimes things slip through. So if you did email me and I didn't get back to you, sorry, or you didn't do a good job. Try again. Permission
we'll
to try
leave you
again.
To ponder which one of those you are.
I don't know. I feel like the industry may, or at least the people targeting me have sort of backslid recently. But that was sort of the takeaway that I got from basically how you were framing up that part of the episode there. Mm-hmm. I know that's not what the section that we highlighted for everybody. I took us on a bit of a tangent here. This is we're talking about not post handoff.
Talking about the handoff. Yeah. The kind of smoothing the handoff, because of course the title is how to keep your sales team from killing your brand and your bottom line. But the brand piece was about the buyer journey and the fact that a lot of what we do as salespeople caters to us as salespeople, not to the customer, and having a nice journey. One of the things that can create a real hitch in that buyer journey or that customer journey is the handoff. If it isn't done smoothly, if like in the clip, like Chad mentioned in the clip, if your SDR is asking a bunch of questions that your AE then goes and asks again, all it does is hurt the credibility of the company and make them less likely to continue further down that buying journey. So smoothing that handoff process, having a set of questions that the SDR asks that are completely different from, but are kind of the foundation to the questions that the AE is going to ask is so important, so important. And I think Chad was actually speaking about a live handoff where the meeting takes place together. And he was saying, you know, like if it's a 50-minute meeting, that AE is not even going to remember half the stuff that was talked about, but it can be 10, 15 minutes and it should be 10, 15 minutes that the SDR is having these, are we a fit questions or qualification questions, whatever you want to call that call, and then making that really smooth transition to the AE meeting. Mm-hmm.
you know, it's really interesting that, and it kind of leads into the next one that we're going to talk about. But I remember a couple of conversations we had with prospects early days that before, this is before Julian, I think even before you, it might have even been before Pete. It could have been Pete though. I remember, let's just say early days predictable revenue, we didn't do a great job of passing that information from call to call, right? Initially, we'd have a sales development rep on the inbound side would take an inbound call, same with an outbound. They would have their notes. They would either put it in the early days, I hate to admit this, but as a Google Doc, and then they would put a link to the Google Doc in Salesforce. It killed me. Drove me insane. And we had a number of prospects, and I was still managing the sales team at this stage, a number of prospects complained that, hey, I've just had this conversation with so-and-so, or I might've heard, I think we were doing call review and with one of our reps. And I remember hearing this, and I'm like, this is, how do we solve this? And what we ended up doing was programming all of that, or creating fields in our Salesforce for all of the questions that our reps were asking. And then those would go in, and if it was an inbound, they'd be entered in on the lead object. And then they'd get pushed over to the opportunity object once it got converted, so that the account executive can lead the call off with, hey, you know, here's what I know so far. One of the things that I loved that we did that it wasn't me, I want to say it was maybe Tristan or Sebastian created this, an additional field that was just a summary. And it was, here's the top three things. You've got all the information, but here are the three things, Mr. AE, that you should, or Mrs. AE, that you should pay attention to. And that was like a huge one to sort of bridge that gap. I know this is sort of a tangent or tangential from what you're talking about, because you're talking about live transfers. You actually lived in this system here. Mm-hmm. You experienced that. Is that a good system? Did that work well?
Yeah, definitely. And we did kind of touch on that with Chad as well, like is there a world where you can just not do it live, where that information is captured so clearly and so completely that you can just do the handoff like the way that we did? Mm-hmm. And Chad says absolutely, and we're of course an example of it done well. But he mentioned that for sales teams that aren't used to using the CRM or don't necessarily use it optimally, trying to get them to put enough information in there, if it's a new practice, you're going to miss some stuff. So it's better to go live to capture everything than to try to put it in the CRM. But of course, if you are using that CRM well, if you've got the really specific fields like we did, that everybody absolutely knows, it's like institutional knowledge, how to fill in those fields. Yes, that's a great way to do it. And it always worked really well on our end. Absolutely.
Oh, it didn't always work really well. And this is actually the really interesting segue, because in the early days, when I was still in charge of things, it actually worked quite poorly. We had two different reps and sales stages meant nothing to us. It was like, you may as well just put your favorite fruit or vegetable as the opportunity status. It literally meant nothing. And it wasn't until I met Jamie Buss that I realized I've been doing everything wrong my entire life. Never before had I knew what our definitions for opportunity stages were, and I'd written them down and I told them to the reps, and I'd reinforce that. And then every time I sat down to do a pipe review, it's like, where are we? I felt lost. Mm-hmm. I felt like I'm exploring a desert island in the new desert island, a new desert island every time, and I had no map. And it was insane. I'm like, you could kind of feel something was wrong. And you're like, I get this, I've done this sale. You know, it kind of feels familiar. Everybody has a slightly different way of approaching it. And it wasn't until I met Jamie that I realized, like, there's a whole other element of the sort of pipeline management that I was missing. And so the episode I'm referring to is episode 59. And it was how Zendesk forecast their revenue within 1%. Now, this was back in 2018, I think, I'm guessing, because we started in 2017, 60 episodes in. I think it was 2018. They were doing about $500 million in revenue at the time. And she was forecasting that on a quarterly basis within 1%, which is insane. And there's two things that she did that were in order to enable her to do that. And the first thing was her opportunity stages. Every single stage, and as Sarah will attest to, ours are pretty well known. It's institutional knowledge now. But every pipeline stage has a customer verifiable outcome. I won't go into all the details, But that's the most important part. And if you want them, if you want the details, we've got a great blog post about it that has some cool graphics, or you can listen to the episode. Highly recommend listening to the episode. I picked this one because it had the biggest impact on Predictable Revenue's Rev team in terms of we actually implemented this and it lives today, and it's had a massive impact on our team. So the first piece is customer verifiable outcomes for every opportunity stage. Everybody's on the same page. So now from a linear perspective in terms of forward progress in the buyer's journey with Predictable Revenue, we know where they're at. So that's the first piece, is we know sort of how far along in the journey they are and how roughly how much time is left. The next thing, and so customer verifiable outcomes, I'd kind of heard about it before. I didn't realize how important it was. So if that's the only thing you take away from this, that'd be a huge win. But there's a bit of a strategy here, because without that, everything else doesn't work. I should say it doesn't work. But when you mix in customer verifiable outcomes for your opportunity stages with a qualification methodology that everybody has the same definitions and everybody uses, and not only uses, but puts that information in your CRM, and Salesforce or whatever CRM you're able to use is able to sort of calculate the score. And ours are very simple. It's a 0, 1, or a 2. So 0 if you don't know what it is, and 1 if you've got some, and 2 if you've got it nailed. That's the important piece. It's like we're not doing any automatic scoring, but there's, I think, 14 total points available. So 7 different pieces that we're scoring for on the medic. So initially Jamie's qualification methodology that we talked about was MedPick. And I'm totally going to draw a blank on all of them, but I'll give it a try. There's the metric, which is basically the number. There's the economic buyer. There's the decision criteria, decision process. There's the, I think paper was the P, or paper process or something like that. There's the I, and then there's C, medic, and then there's competition and champion. And then the I was, I'm totally drawing a blank here. I knew I was going to miss one. Anyway, I didn't want to let myself look it up and then pretend to be smart. I wanted to actually try and go from identified pain. Thank you. I'm thanking myself for remembering. So basically, we take in each of these categories and you score them on a scale of 0, 1, or 2. And the most important piece to me when I was looking at doing our pipe review was where in the opportunity stage are you? So how far along in the journey are you? What is your overall medic score? And then the ones that I'd really bust our AEs on, and Pete can probably attest to this because, he always did a great job, but he was in the early days when I was maybe a little bit less subtle about things, was the identified pain and then the metric. And the way those two work together is the identified pain is what you would think of as pain. This is the thing that in their life that's wrong. And the way that works with metric is this is how you quantify that pain. So if I'm running, shy on meetings, or if I'm not hitting my pipeline goals, or if I'm not, if I'm thinking about like predictable revenue pains that we're looking for, it's like I've got aggressive growth targets and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to hit those. That's your identified pain. And then the metric is how you quantify that. It's like, okay, so how many meetings a month, or how many opportunities, or how many sales are you off? And I think that element of being able to assess the quality of information that we know, it's not necessarily the quality of the sales process or the quality of the job that your rep has done, but it's the quality of information that we have. So have they done a good job of gathering the appropriate information from the prospect? And where are they at? Like what was the last step we were able to verify that they've taken? And I think that to me was all of a sudden, it's that moment in the matrix when Neo can see all the bits, he can see the source code, and it's like, I can suddenly see and feel. That to me was a truly eye-opening experience. We're going to listen to a clip here, and then I'd love to hear Sarah's feedback, because not only like did you grow up in the system, you used this and contributed to making it better. So let's listen to the clip and then we'll come back for Sarah's comments and thoughts.
So I had to come up with a way of combining forecasting the long tail, which I'm not going to get into now. I'm not the ops person. So I have an ops person that helps me do that. And that's a lot of trends and analysis to figure out, okay, if we look at the business by new, by expansion, and by deal size, how has it been trending quarter over quarter and year over year? What is the headcount we've put against it? And then what is the expected return of those headcount investment and the growth we expect in that kind of quarter and quarter business? So that's a definitely more operational kind of math exercise. I need to complement that with the deals that are actually in my pipeline. And then I have to figure out, well, how many of those are going to close? Because that's going to add up to be the total. And I think for me, it was, that was the one part of I wasn't in Kansas anymore. How do I marry those two things? And then once I really got into the pipeline, I realized the team did not have, like, if someone were to tell me something was in stage two, that meant different things to different people. Stage three meant different things to different people. We weren't speaking the same language. So I needed to come up with a common language that the whole sales team could use for both sales process and qualification methodology, so that when I was asking people doing the waterboarding exercise in a forecast call, that when I asked them about stage three, we all knew what that meant. And it was very, it was a lot easier for me then to predict, okay, I can apply some probabilities to my sales stages and really start to assess what is going to be my conversion rate out of my existing opportunities based on how far along they are in the funnel.
It's amazing the impact that having that common language to communicate with the whole team, the impact that that can have. Mm-hmm. I've lived in situations where, just like you, we're calling stage two, two dramatically different things. And I know, you know, I'm sitting across the table at another rep and I'm like, I know your stage two is just all garbage. Like, my stage two actually means something. And I felt bad for, you know, the VP at the end of the table trying to make sense of what we were talking about. Cause like, I know I'm going to hit my quota. Cause I don't care about his quota, but I know I'm going to hit mine. And I know his pipeline is made up of magic fairy dust and unicorns and all these mythical creatures that it's not going to turn into dollars on his paycheck.
Yep. No, that's absolutely true. So I feel so much more confident in our deals. And it actually gave our reps a lot more confidence too. Because now when they look and they see, if they start off the quarter and a good deal amount of their deals are in stage three or four, they can feel a lot more confident in their commit. So one thing I noticed is that the team commits very conservatively, right? They're almost committing their worst case. And I have to kind of force them to be like, okay, I understand there's risk, but I need you to commit a higher number and then articulate to me what that risk is. But I can't have you come in and forecast your worst case, because I barely need a rep to cover that worst case. I need you to fill the gap between that and where you need to get to. So help, you know, walk me through that. So I think we're definitely getting better at that, but without having that common language, I don't think it wouldn't have been possible. It's just the data was almost meaningless. There was a deal with opportunity with a MRR, monthly recurring revenue associated to it. That's kind of all I had. Right. So in any case, and we can kind of walk through the details of when we're ready here to kind of walk through what that sales process is. I think we did something a little different there too, that really helped us compared to what I'd done in the past.
Love that clip with Jamie. Yeah. I'm a huge, huge fan of Jamie. She's one of the people we've actually had on the podcast twice. If you haven't listened to that episode, I highly recommend it. If you're not in a closing role, or if you're not in a sales management role, still worth listening to, because they're talking about basically how to quantify, in Sarah's words that she just mentioned a few minutes ago, how to quantify something that previously was fairly subjective. Some of those calls are still going to be subjective, but bringing a framework to it, you're going to be subjective in the same way, and you're bringing a little bit more objectivity to it. So I love that. If it's not super relevant to you, if you're you're a rep, you're an SDR looking to be an AE, or an AE looking to be a sales manager, I can't remember the episode, but we had Jimmy back on the podcast to talk about that path to management. Zendesk has a great program for taking somebody who is currently carrying a bag or has a quota and giving them a chance to taste sales management, so that you don't have to, you know, make the jump from AE to sales manager or whatever it is, because it is quite a different role. Mm-hmm. And so I want to throw back to Sarah, because I know you didn't specifically engage with our Medic system, which in Salesforce is as beautiful as Salesforce can possibly be, but you do have some experience trying to quantify something that's relatively subjective. So we're going to throw a little bonus shout out to an episode here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah. So similarly to
to Jamie's strategy, the idea of assigning a number or a quantitative, whether it's like a symbol or numeric or whatever you want to assign to something that, as you said, would formerly be seen as qualitative, is something that Jeff Kozer of Zebrify, or Zebrify for the Americans out there, it's something that he and the team have designed there. And the zebra or the zebra for them is your ideal customer.
You call them zebras?
Zebra, yeah.
Is that
what do you call it?
Zebra.
Ew.
Is that the Canadian way to say it? I think it's
the British zebra actually. Way? Zebra and my parents are. I learned my animals in England, so
of course
it's stuck. Okay, zebra. Then we'll go zebra.
No.
I don't want to rub anybody the wrong way, Colin.
Hey, you're welcome to use whatever language that you decide to.
Well, it feels authentic to me to say zebra,
and so. I support you, even though you're wrong. I support you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. That's one of the wonderful things about working for Predictable Revenue is this undying support. So Jeff Kozer, zebra. A zebra is your ideal customer profile. The reason it is a zebra is because, like I just referred to there, a kid can look at it and know what it is. Like, there's no confusing what it is. It's one of the most identifiable animals. And the idea is that your idea of your ideal customer profile should be that concrete. So he teaches you how to get there. And then a similar sort of opportunity scoring system, where you assign a numerical value to each stage, and sort of the readiness at each stage, similar to Jamie's approach. So I think it's called Hunting Your Zebra or something like that, but it's the Jeff Kozer episode. And it's a brilliant one for a kind of a different but similar approach to mapping out something in a mathematical way that normally would just be absolutely gut feel and you know, throwing caution to the wind and hoping that you close everything.
Mm-hmm. I think anytime you can start to remove a little bit of the subjectivity out of the way that you manage your pipeline, the way you manage your people, I think is a huge win, especially in sales, when so much of what we do comes down to, you know, it's a subjective call. So anything that you can do to bring even the slightest semblance of data to something that's, something like that, I'm a huge fan.
Something so human.
Yeah, absolutely. And genuinely, I can say that bringing in Jamie's process into Predictable Revenue has made PR better, has made our people better, has given us a better ability to coach them. Because before, we were not able to really triangulate like where reps were missing deals, because you don't know, because everything is so subjective, because you don't have the map in front of you, or you have a map, but all the markers are different. Every time you look at the map, everything's changed. And so I think that's why I picked this episode, because it had one, it was mind blowing for me just to meet somebody of Jamie's caliber and get a chance to learn from her, and two, that we implemented this. And I can't remember the name of the guy who did the follow up, but we'll track down. It was somebody who worked with Jamie at Zendesk in the early days and actually built this all into Salesforce. And so if you are looking to implement this episode, we'll have a link hopefully in the show notes, if you're listening to the podcast, or in the description if you're on YouTube. And I'm hoping the guys, I can see it was Mesosphere. I think it was David Mesosphere. Anyway, so if you are looking to build this into your Salesforce, there is a way, it's fairly easy. I was able to do it. The only thing I couldn't get going was the stoplight graphic, and I got one version, but I couldn't get the one that I wanted. It was just like a light, not like the full stoplight, and I wanted the full stoplight. So that's the one thing that I had to get a Salesforce contractor, and he's like, oh, you just change this bit. So anyway, I'm rambling. I'm a huge fan, and was very grateful to have Jamie on the show twice.
Yeah, super interesting. And that kind of concludes our wrap up of the past 200 episodes. What a journey. What a huge amount of incredibly talented and you know, amazing people that we've had the pleasure of interviewing. It's such an amazing privilege to be able to host all these people on the podcast.
I've loved the opportunity to learn from not just the guests, but our team and our listeners. We've had some amazing callouts, a bunch of people write in with questions, with comments, with thoughts. We've even had a few of them on the show. So I want to say thank you if you've been a listener for even a couple of episodes, even one episode. If this is your first one, this would be a weird one to tune into, but welcome. And thank you for listening. Big shout out to the team. They have made this super easy for me to just show up, pull my mic in, hit record. And then once the Zoom meeting ends, I do nothing. Like I might get, you know, Sarah and I might get a lot of the credit for being on the show. We probably do about 15% of the work at most.
If that.
If totally. That. That might be, I'm rounding up from like 8%.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much that goes in, goes on behind the scenes. So thank you to everybody that does the podcast write-ups, that gets these things shared out, that edits them, that makes them look great, that makes them sound great, that makes sure that we actually have guests, that makes sure that they get published. So many great people that work behind the scenes that don't get any of the credit. Big shout out there. And to the 163 guests that I got a chance to talk to, probably more like 160, because I think we had a couple people jump on twice. So,
yeah. Yeah. And thank you to Colin for crawling for 163 episodes so that I could fly as the majestic podcast bird that I am. So thank you for giving me your ugly baby so that I could see it grow into a beautiful woman podcast. No, thank you so much for the opportunity. It's amazing that you've put in 163 episodes of great work to build this foundation of like a huge listenership. People want to be on the podcast. People are excited to listen to it, to be on it. So I really am grateful for the opportunity to get to be a host. Thank you to the people who had listened to Colin for 163 episodes and then didn't stop listening when a stranger showed up and was hosting instead. So yeah. Thank you to everybody. Of course. Thank you to the team. Yeah. You guys are absolutely incredible. Listeners, guests, team, that's all of you guys. You're all great.
I don't even know if I said a thank you to Sarah. Thank you to Sarah, because I mean, for one, so interesting story at the beginning, you were talking about Bilal. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking the other day and I saw Bilal and Sarah and I was like, oh, did we have him back on the podcast? Because in my head, I remember recording that episode, mm-hmm. but I wasn't actually capable of speaking and it was you on the episode, but I did do the pre-interview. So that's what I was thinking. And I was like, oh, we had him back on, but we talked about the same thing. That's a really strange one. And it's happened a while ago. I was so, so confused because I was 100% sure that I had recorded that. So mm-hmm. anyway, thank you for stepping in with very little prep, with very little warning. And suddenly I was just like, well, I found a sucker to take over the show and I'm out of here. And you've taken it, you've ran with it. You're doing a phenomenal job. I like listening. It's so much better that my voice and face isn't on this thing anymore. And I really appreciate all the hard work that you put into this. I think you've made the show great. You've made it your own. And I'm really stoked that, that you got value out of it too, that you enjoy it, and three, you've done such an amazing job with it. So thank you.
Thank you. Well, I can't wait for the next 100.
There you go. It's going to be a while to break my streak. I might just like
it's true.
Come back and just keep doing some episodes keep just like so you can't take breaking the record my from streak. Me.
Yeah. Okay. Nice.
Yeah. I think that's all the show notes. We're at the end. One last thank you to the listeners for listening to us ramble on. Probably a little bit more than I usually do in most of these. But you're the reason we show up. And if there's anything that we missed, if there's any favorites that you had, I'd love to hear about it in the comments. I don't check all of them, but I will check these ones here and I will make sure that we get back to everybody. So let me know, what were some of your highlights, some of your favorites, whether it was an old one with the old guy on it or some of the new beautiful butterfly women ones. I don't know what the morphosis happening there turned like that, into, yeah. But the ones with Sarah on them, obviously the quality stepped up quite a bit. So let me know which ones were your favorites.
Yeah, well, I'd love to hear that.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody. See ya.
See you.